Welcome to The Bloody Bible, the podcast where we explore why our fascination with crime is as old as the Bible itself. I'm Kaz.
And I'm Em. And in today's episode, we'll be talking about a woman called Hagar, who appears in the book of Genesis.
Okay, so Hagar might be a familiar character to some of our listeners. We usually hear about her in the context of the story of Abraham and Sarah, don't we? Can you tell our listeners a bit about her and why you've chosen her as the focus of this episode, Em?
Sure. So Hagar is a relatively well-known biblical character, but I want us to think about her in a way that perhaps listeners aren't quite so familiar with. I want us to consider Hagar as an enslaved woman who is used by her enslavers, Abraham and Sarah, to bear a child for them. I want us to think about Hagar's experience as a victim of sexual subjugation at the hands of both Abraham and Sarah, and to think more about Sarah's participation in the sexual victimization of another, less powerful woman. So, just a heads up to our listeners, we'll be spending much of today's episode discussing enslavement, rape, and sexual exploitation. If you find these topics particularly triggering, you may want to skip this episode.
And as usual, we'll make sure to leave some links to relevant support services in our show notes. So, Em, I have heard some biblical scholars argue that because the practice of enslavement was an accepted institution in the ancient biblical world, we can't really critique it or judge it by our contemporary standards. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I've heard this argument as well, but I don't really agree with it. Because the same ideologies that scaffold enslavement in the biblical world, such as patriarchy, imperialism, racial supremacy, and class privilege, remain a powerful presence in our contemporary world. And we need to remember that enslavement and sexual subjugation are far from a thing of the past.
Yeah, I agree. That's so true. I came across a report recently which was issued in 2021 by the International Labour Organization. And it estimated that at least 50 million people are currently experiencing enslavement. That figure includes 28 million people enslaved in forced labour and 22 million enslaved in forced marriages. Women and children make up around 70% of people who are currently enslaved, and they're particularly vulnerable to forced marriages and forced pregnancy. We should also remember that modern enslavement isn't something that only happens in remote corners of the world. It occurs in almost every country globally, and it affects people from different ethnic, cultural, and religious contexts. More than half of all forced labour and a quarter of all forced marriages occur in upper middle income or high income countries.
Goodness, those stats are really horrific, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are.
So I think that Hagar's story can help open up conversations about contemporary women's experiences of enslavement. And Hagar's experience can also help us to understand how intersecting layers of oppression, such as race, gender, class, and age, can render some women and girls incredibly vulnerable to enslavement and sexual subjugation. It's not good enough to dismiss enslavement as an accepted institution in the biblical world. We can't read biblical stories about enslavement without confronting the violence inherent within these stories and calling them out. Because if we refuse to recognize the violence of biblical enslavement, then we're essentially saying that enslavement is acceptable in certain contexts. And of course, enslavement is never acceptable, regardless of when or where it occurred.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that speaks to one of the main issues we want to address in this podcast as a whole. If we don't call out the violence we see in the biblical texts, then we're essentially saying it's not that important, or it's not relevant to us, so we can simply ignore it. And what does that say about our attitudes to violence in our own cultures and our own communities? How does that impact the way we treat victims and survivors?
Exactly.
So how are we going to tackle Hagar's story, Em?
I want to take a closer look at the two chapters in Genesis where Hagar makes an appearance. We'll discuss how her status as an enslaved woman shapes and restricts her experiences. And throughout our discussion, I'll be drawing on the work of a womanist scholar, Wilda Gaffney, particularly her book entitled Womanist Midrash, A Reintroduction to the Women of the Torah and the Throne, which was published in 2017.
Oh, it's such a brilliant book, isn't it?
Such a brilliant book. And I think there's a second volume coming out pretty soon. And as is our custom, Kaz, along the way, I'll get you to think about how these biblical stories resonate with contemporary cases of women's sexual enslavement and victimization.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
Let's begin with Genesis 16, where we first meet Hagar. Kaz, could you please read out verses 1 to 3 and the first part of verse 4?
Sure. Now, I should just say that in Genesis 12 to 16, Abraham is known as Avram and Sarah is called Sarai. God changes their name in Genesis chapter 17 to Abraham and Sarah, respectively. But to avoid everyone getting confused, we'll just use the names Abraham and Sarah throughout the episode. Does that sound okay?
Perfect.
So I'm reading Genesis 16, verses 1 to 3 and the first part of verse 4. Now Sarah, Abram's wife, bore him no children. She had an enslaved Egyptian woman whose name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abraham, "You see that the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my enslaved woman. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarah. So after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarah, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her enslaved woman, and gave her to her husband Abram as a wife. He had sex with Hagar, and she conceived.
Okay, so what are your first thoughts about this story, Kaz?
Well, what strikes me straight away is how Hagar is portrayed as being utterly different to Sarah and Abram. She is enslaved, they are her enslavers. She is Egyptian, they are Hebrew. She has no agency or ability to make decisions about her own body. She's rendered completely passive and voiceless in these opening verses, while Abram and Sarah discuss her and make decisions about her. There seems to be a huge power disparity at play here, doesn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Hagar is the other, or the outsider, in Abraham and Sarah's household. And her vulnerability is marked by three intersecting features of her identity. First, she's a woman living in a patriarchal world. Second, she's a foreign woman born in the land of Egypt. And third, she's an enslaved woman who would have been considered the property of her enslavers. Now, I don't know if you noticed, Kaz, but her Egyptian ethnicity and her enslaved status gets mentioned more than once in those verses you've just read out. It's as though the narrator really wants us to focus on these features of her identity.
Yeah, and I also noticed that we're not given any details about who Hagar is, other than the fact that she came from Egypt. How old was she? Did she have a family back in Egypt? Did she ever get homesick? How did she feel about Abram and Sarah bringing her to the land of Canaan? And most importantly, what did she think about their decision to have her bear them a child? I mean, we don't get any insights at all into how she's feeling at this point in the story, do we?
No, we don't. From the outset, Hagar is treated as an object. Abraham and Sarah are making decisions about her body and denying her reproductive choice. They decide that Abraham will have sex with her until she falls pregnant, and there's nothing that Hagar can do about it, given her enslaved status.
That sounds like coercion to me, which, in my mind, means that Hagar is a victim of sexual violence.
Yes, I agree. As an enslaved woman, Hagar has no ability to withhold her consent. She couldn't say no to Abraham and Sarah. And while the text only mentions one occasion that Abraham had sex with Hagar, he may well have raped her on multiple occasions before she fell pregnant.
Yeah, that's true. So just going back to Sarah's decision to make Hagar bear a child for her, do you know if this is something that happened regularly during the biblical period?
I'm not sure how common it was, but Hagar is not the only biblical woman whose body is used to bear children for her enslavers. So in Genesis 30, we read that Jacob's two wives, Leah and Rachel, used their enslaved women, Zilpah and Bilhah, to bear children on their behalf, and between them, Zilpah and Bilhah give birth to four of Jacob's sons. Now, there are two Hebrew terms used to describe the status of Hagar, Bilhah, and Zilpah, Shivcha and Almah. These words seem to be used interchangeably and are often translated as maid or maidservant. But as Wilda Gaffney points out, these women are not maids or maidservants. They're not paid for their service. They're enslaved. And we need to make that distinction clear in the way we translate these texts.
Yes, I completely agree. The words maid and maidservant really conceal or whitewash the violence that's inherent in the structures of enslavement.
Exactly. Now, according to Jewish studies scholar Diane Krieger, a woman who was a shifcha or ama, an enslaved woman, might sometimes be given the role of a wife so that she could bear children for her enslavers. That's why we read in Genesis 16:3 that Sarah gave Hagar to Abraham, quote, as a wife. And just as an aside, the same language is used in Genesis 30, verses 4 and 9, where Bilhah and Zilpah are given as wives to Jacob.
Does that mean these women would be freed from enslavement now that they're officially a wife?
No, that's the thing. They'd still be enslaved, but they would also occupy the role of a wife.
Ah, okay.
So as an enslaved woman, Hagar would have had no choice but to comply with both the marriage and the childbearing arrangements described in Genesis 16.
Now, I mentioned earlier that forced marriage is a prevalent feature of modern enslavement. Forced marriages occur when a person is compelled to enter a marriage that they do not consent to, and they're unable to leave that marriage. Now, victims of forced marriage are predominantly women and girls, and underage girls make up around 40% of the cases. And that makes me wonder how old Hagar was. She could have been in her early teens or her mid-teens for all we know.
Yeah, that's true. And going back to your point about forced marriages, Kaz, I presume that any woman or girl enslaved in a forced marriage will also have to endure forced pregnancies too.
Yeah, that's right. Forced pregnancy occurs when a woman or girl becomes pregnant against her own wishes, and abortion is denied, hindered, or delayed. According to feminist legal scholar Pamela Bridgewater, forced pregnancy compels women and girls to do unpaid reproductive labour on behalf of others, and so it can be regarded as a form of enslavement. And that's what we see happening to Hagar, isn't it? She's doing unpaid and non-consensual reproductive labour for Abraham and Sarah.
Yeah, absolutely. Hagar's life and her body are not her own. It's Sarah who decides that Hagar will bear a child for her. It's Sarah who tells Abraham that he must have sex with Hagar. Hagar gets no say in the matter at all. They're planning to use her body, or to be more precise, her womb, to bear a child, whether she wants them to or not. I found a really powerful quote from an article by biblical scholar James Okoye, and he says, quote, "Hagar is seen as a possession, a disposable commodity that can exchange hands at the will of the owner. She does not need to be asked what she feels about the arrangement. Her feelings are of no consequence in the transaction." In the entire narrative, Sarah never speaks directly to Hagar.
Ah, that's such a good quote. I must check out that article. And yet, Abram and Sarah really dehumanize Hagar throughout this process, don't they? As you said, they treat her as nothing more than a walking womb. There's no sense of relationship between them. You get no indication that Sarah sees Hagar as a fellow human being, let alone a fellow woman.
No, none at all. Sarah and Hagar may both be women, but Sarah is freeborn and Hagar is enslaved. And this crucial difference in their social status trumps their shared gender and dictates their relationship.
Why do you think Sarah makes this decision to use Hagar in this way? Are her motives ever explained clearly in the text?
Well, in Genesis 15, God promises Abraham that he will father a son and that he'll go on to have countless descendants. But at the start of chapter 16, we're reminded that Sarah is unable to get pregnant. So that leaves us with an unanswered question. Who's going to bear Abraham's promised son? The text suggests that Sarah decides to take matters into her own hands by finding another way for Abraham to get a son and heir. And this comes out in verse 2 when she says to Abraham, "You see that the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my enslaved woman. It may be that I shall obtain children by her."
Okay, so Sarah wants to ensure that God's promise to Abram can be realized. Is that her only motive?
Well, there's another factor that we should consider here, although it's not made explicit in the Genesis 16 text. In the biblical period, a woman's social status was dependent to a large part on her fertility and her capacity to bear sons for her husband. A woman unable to bear children, especially sons, would have been viewed as less worthy, less valuable to her family and community. Wilda Gaffney makes this point, saying, quote, "Sarah is free. She has some societal privilege as Abraham's woman and Hagar's mistress, but she's still an infertile woman in a male-dominated world, both of which imperil her status. She seeks to attain or restore her status on and in Hagar's body."
Okay, that's worth keeping in mind. Now, I have heard some biblical scholars say that Hagar acts as a so-called surrogate mother for Sarah. Do you think that's an accurate term to use?
Yeah, I'm not too sure about using the language of surrogacy here. Contemporary surrogacy arrangements don't typically involve sexual coercion or subjugation, although there are occasions where the issue of consent is complicated due to the surrogate mother's vulnerability, her financial precarity, or her marginalized social status. But given Hagar's own status as an enslaved woman, it might be more appropriate to compare her experiences with those of enslaved women in more recent history. Wilda Gaffney mentions that many African and African American enslaved women in the 18th and 19th centuries were, like Hagar, raped by their enslavers to produce children. Gaffney invites us to, quote, "read Hagar's story through the prism of the wholesale enslavement of black peoples in the Americas and elsewhere."
Yeah, I think that's a more helpful comparison than the language of surrogacy. And Pamela Bridgewater also discusses the wholesale rape of enslaved women by their enslavers in the United States. And she mentions that children born to enslaved women as the result of these rapes were considered the property of their enslavers, not of their birth mother. And that seems to resonate with Hagar's experience in Genesis 16, doesn't it? So, can you tell us what happens next?
Yes, let's read on. Could you read out Genesis chapter 16, verses 4 to 6 for us, please, Kaz?
Sure. "When Hagar saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. Then Sarah said to Abram, 'May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my enslaved woman to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me.' But Abram said to Sarah, 'Your enslaved woman is in your power. Do to her as you please.' Then Sarah treated Hagar so harshly that she ran away from her." Now, I'm curious about what's going on here. Why is Hagar looking at Sarah with contempt? What do you think that means?
Well, some biblical scholars suggest that Hagar starts behaving arrogantly towards Sarah because her pregnancy makes her feel superior to the still infertile Sarah.
Okay, and that would tie in with what you said earlier about infertility being a source of stigma and shame for biblical women.
It would, but I'm still not convinced it's the only way or even the best way to interpret Hagar's response here. The Hebrew word used to describe her behaviour can mean to despise, to curse, and to treat with contempt. Wilda Gaffney suggests that Hagar is angry that Sarah orchestrated her rape by Abraham and is now forcing her to carry the child which resulted from that rape. Hagar's fertility was likely her only source of power, but Sarah has taken control of that too and used it to her own advantage.
So Hagar looks at Sarah with contempt because Sarah is exploiting Hagar's enslaved body to meet her own needs. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And if we think about it, interpreters who suggest Hagar is simply being uppity or arrogant are essentially ignoring the abuse that Sarah has inflicted on her. Surely it makes more sense to think that Hagar's response is fueled by her anger and hostility towards the woman responsible for her sexual subjugation. I mean, why should we expect Hagar to remain passive and compliant about her abuse at the hands of her enslaver?
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm also interested in Abram's response here to Sarah's complaints. He says, "Your enslaved woman is in your hands, do to her as you please." He's really not interested in getting involved in this dispute between his two wives, is he?
No, he's not. he effectively removes himself from the situation and gives Sarah free rein to treat Hagar however she likes. And I think this suggests that while Hagar is also Abraham's wife, she's not an equal to Sarah. She's still an enslaved woman. And Abraham confirms this when he tells Sarah that Hagar is, quote, in her hands, or in other words, Sarah has power over Hagar and can treat her however she wants. And so, as we read in the text, Sarah, quote, dealt harshly with Hagar.
What do you think that means? Harshly in what sense?
So the Hebrew word used here has a range of meanings, but its basic sense is to afflict or oppress. It can refer to emotional oppression, where someone humiliates or demeans another person or group. But it's also used to denote physical oppression and violation. To give you a few examples, it's used in Exodus 1 to describe the brutal treatment of the Israelites when they're enslaved in Egypt. It also appears in three biblical texts, Genesis 34, Judges 20, and 2 Samuel 13, to describe the act of rape. So it's clearly a word that can denote some very harsh and often violent treatment.
Okay, and so in Genesis 16, it could refer to Sarah emotionally and or physically abusing Hagar, right?
Yeah, it could. But whatever Sarah did to Hagar, it was clearly enough to make Hagar run away. And I think that speaks to her desperation. She was pregnant, she was far from home, she had nothing, no possessions, no resources, no source of support. But despite that, she must have thought that running away was her only option.
Yeah, she must have been feeling really, really desperate. So what happens to her after she runs away?
We're told she's found by an angel who delivers a message to her from God. First, God gives her the command, return to your mistress and submit to her. Then God promises her that he will, quote, greatly multiply your offspring and they shall be too many to count. So God promises Hagar that she shall bear a son called Ishmael, quote, for the Lord has given heed to your affliction.
That part about her having multiple descendants is very similar to God's earlier promise to Abraham, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So in a sense, Hagar is really elevated in this scene, not to mention the fact that she's visited by the angel of the Lord. But I can't get over the fact that God tells her that she must return to her enslaver and abuser, Sarah, and submit to her. And I find it ironic that her son is to be called Ishmael, which means God hears. Because that suggests God is aware of Hagar's plight, but he still expects her to return to an abusive situation in the house of her enslavers.
Yeah, it doesn't sit well with me either. Wilder Gaffney suggests that this reifies or illustrates Hagar's status as an enslaved woman, and it demonstrates just how powerless and vulnerable she is. She's essentially being told to submit to Sarah and endure her abuse. And that in turn only downplays the seriousness of the violence Hagar is experiencing, her ongoing enslavement, her sexual subjugation, and her abuse at the hands of Sarah.
Yeah, it really does downplay it. So how does Hagar respond to God's message?
Well, in Genesis 16:13, we read that Hagar, quote, named the Lord who spoke to her, you are Elroy, which means God of seeing or God who sees. And then she said, quote, for have I not gone on seeing after my being seen? Now, on the one hand, this is really significant because it makes Hagar the only person in the Bible to give God a personal name. And that reaffirms that she's a really significant biblical figure. But on the other hand, it disturbs me that Hagar is said to name God Elroy, God who sees, because what God sees here is a woman who endured so much abuse, but he still tells her to return and submit to Sarah.
But isn't that also a response we've heard being given to women in abusive relationships so many times?
In what way, Kaz?
Well, I'm thinking particularly of victims of intimate partner violence who might consult a priest or a minister or another religious leader to ask for their help, only to be told that they must go back to their husband and submit to him and put up with the abuse, or to suffer just like Christ suffered. It happens all too often. And for me, the scene in Genesis 16 speaks to that injustice of women being trapped in a highly abusive situation or relationship. And whenever they try to leave, someone's there pushing them back, whether it's their abuser or the people they turn to for help. Oh, it's really infuriating.
Yeah, it really is. And I agree. It's quite a powerful comparison to make with Hagar's situation here.
Does the text tell us what happens to Hagar when she returns to Abraham and Sarah?
No, it doesn't. So for all we know, Sarah may well have gone on treating her harshly. But we're told that the angel's pronouncement comes true. Verse 15 reads, Hagar bore Abraham a son, and Abraham named his son, whom Hagar bore, Ishmael.
The wording here is interesting, isn't it? The baby is identified as Abraham's son, not Hagar's.
Yeah, because at this point, the child belongs to Sarah and Abraham. Hagar has fulfilled her function. She gave birth to Ishmael. So that's the end of her involvement in his life, or at least for now.
Oh, that sounds intriguing. Tell us what happens next, Em.
Well, Hagar disappears from the narrative until Genesis chapter 21, where Sarah orchestrates further violence against her. But, plot twist, at the start of this chapter, we learn that Sarah does become pregnant herself, and she gives birth to a son who is named Isaac by his father Abraham.
How does the birth of Isaac affect Sarah's treatment of Hagar?
Well, as we discover, things go badly wrong. Can you read Genesis 21 verses 8 to 10, please, Kaz?
Sure. The child, Isaac, grew and was weaned, and Abram made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abram, playing with her son Isaac. So she said to Abram, "Cast out this enslaved woman with her son, for the son of this enslaved woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac." Whoa, okay, things escalated quickly there, didn't they? Why do you think Sarah reacted like that? What did she see Ishmael doing?
Yeah, it's not clear why Sarah is so upset here. Some scholars suggest that Ishmael was mistreating Isaac in some way, maybe bullying him or laughing at him. Others believe that Sarah's main concern was Ishmael's status in relation to Isaac. As Abraham's firstborn son, Ishmael would be expected to inherit his father's land and property. So maybe Sarah thought that it was Isaac who deserved this inheritance rather than the son of an enslaved woman.
Yeah, I noticed she refers to Ishmael as the son of the enslaved woman rather than as Abram's son.
Yeah, I noticed that too. Sarah might also have been concerned about God's promise to Abraham that his descendants would become a great nation. Maybe she wanted to ensure that this destiny originated from Isaac rather than from Ishmael.
It's just so frustrating though, isn't it? Because Sarah effectively orchestrated this entire situation. It was her actions that saw Hagar become Abram's wife and the birth mother of his firstborn son. But now, because it's no longer suits Sarah's purpose, she wants to sweep it all away, as though it had never happened. But tell me, Em, how does Abraham respond to Sarah's demands here?
So verse 11 says, quote, "The matter was very distressing to Abraham on account of his son."
So Abraham is distressed about Ishmael, but he doesn't mention Hagar?
He does not. And in verses 12 to 13, we're told how God responds to Abraham's distress. Kaz, can you read that out, please?
Sure. So God says, "Do not be distressed over the boy and over your enslaved woman. Whatever Sarah tells you, do as she says. For it is through Isaac that offspring shall be named for you. As for the son of the enslaved woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring." My goodness, even God doesn't mention Hagar or Ishmael by name. They're simply the boy and the enslaved woman. It really depersonalizes them, doesn't it? They're just objects to be used and then discarded when they're no longer useful.
Exactly.
So what happens next, Em? Does Abram do what Sarah wants him to?
Yeah, he does. We read in verse 14 that, quote, "Early the next morning, Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder, together with the boy, and sent her away. And she wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba."
It's interesting, isn't it, that Ishmael is referred to here again as the boy rather than Abram's son. And the narrator says that Abram sends Hagar away rather than saying that Abram sends Hagar and Ishmael away.
Why do you think that's significant?
Well, I think it might help mitigate or obscure the fact that Abram is sending his own son into the wilderness with a few sparse provisions. And that in itself is essentially a death sentence, isn't it?
Yeah, you're right, it is. If Hagar is carrying the provisions herself, it's unlikely she had that much to keep them alive for long. And even though God has previously reassured Abraham that Ishmael will survive and thrive, it doesn't make Abraham's actions here any less reprehensible, not least because the fate of Hagar is simply forgotten.
So what happens to Hagar and Ishmael in the wilderness?
Okay, well, I don't want to leave you in suspense, Kaz. So do you want to read out verses 15 and 16?
Sure. When the water in the skin was gone, she left the child under one of the bushes, and she went and sat down at a distance, a bowshot away. For she thought, let me not look on as the child dies. And as she sat across from him, she lifted up her voice and wept. Oh my goodness, that is so heartrending.
It really is, eh? Hagar is the first woman in the Bible to weep over her dying child. And according to feminist biblical scholar Phyllis Tribble, this marks Hagar out as the prototype of all biblical mothers who likewise weep for their children.
Oh, that actually reminds me of women in more recent history too, whose activism inspired the Thursdays in Black movement.
Can you tell me a bit more about that, Kaz?
Sure. So Thursdays in Black was originally formed by the World Council of Churches in the 1990s, and its aim was to raise awareness of various injustices, including political oppression, wartime rape, and other forms of gender-based abuse. The movement was inspired by different activist groups around the world, including one in Buenos Aires called Mothers of the Disappeared, where mothers would hold a public protest every Thursday against the disappearance of their children during Argentina's violent dictatorship. And it just made me think about Hagar's cries in the wilderness here. Yes, they're driven by grief over the imminent death of her son, but what if they're also cries of protest? What if she's raising up her voice against the injustices of enslavement and against her own sexual subjugation and against the violent neglect of her son by his own father?
Wow, that's such an interesting way to read this verse, because it also serves to empower Hagar, in a limited way at least.
Oh, can you explain what you mean?
Well, despite Hagar's own vulnerabilities at this point in the story, she can still use her voice to bear witness to and protest against the injustice she's experienced.
Yeah, that's a helpful way to afford Hagar some agency in this narrative without undermining her status as a victim and survivor of the most awful abuse. So tell us, Em, does God hear Hagar's cries, her protests in the wilderness?
Not entirely. Do you want to read out verses 17 to 19, please, Kaz?
Sure. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy and hold him fast with your hand, for I will make a great nation of him. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and gave the boy a drink. Okay, so I'm very happy that God sends an angel before it's too late. But I'm also disappointed that God responds to Ishmael's cries, not Hagar's, as though her cries aren't worthy of being heard in the heavens.
Yeah, that's pretty frustrating, hey?
Yeah. But it is a very moving scene, isn't it? Hagar finds the well, and the first thing she does is give her son a drink of water. Even though she's facing death herself, she still puts his needs before her own.
Yeah, and I think that's a natural thing for her to do, because he's her son, her own flesh and blood. Abraham and Sarah may be Ishmael's legitimate parents, but she's the one who truly cares about his well-being.
So, Em, is this the end of the story, or do we hear anything else about what happens to Hagar and Ishmael?
Not really. All we're told in Genesis 21, verses 20 to 21, is that, quote, God was with the boy, and he grew up. He lived in the wilderness and became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt.
So God is with Ishmael, but it's less clear if God is in any way with Hagar. She's not even named in these verses. She's just referred to as Ishmael's mother.
Yeah, Hagar is sidelined once again in her own narrative. To be sure, she and Ishmael have something of a happy ending. They're free from enslavement, as far as we can tell, and it appears that they return to Hagar's homeland of Egypt. But it just feels so unsatisfying, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really, really does.
Within the narratives of Genesis 16 and 21, Hagar suffers enslavement, forced marriage, rape, forced pregnancy, harsh treatment, and a near-death experience in the wilderness. And all of this is orchestrated by Abraham and Sarah, particularly Sarah. Even God seems to be complicit in Hagar's ongoing abuse.
Yes, that's very true. I feel as though readers are being invited to see all this violence inflicted on Hagar. But like God and like Abraham and Sarah, they're also being encouraged to not see it for what it is or to not take it seriously.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So I have a final question for you, Em. We've mentioned throughout the podcast that Sarah played a key role in orchestrating Hagar's sexual subjugation, as well as mistreating Hagar herself. And I want to try to understand that a bit better, because we spend a lot of time in this podcast talking about men who sexually abuse and subjugate women, but we don't say much about women who enable such violence to happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. And women's violence against other women isn't unheard of, is it?
No, it's not. And if I recall, we've mentioned this briefly in one of our earlier episodes. But just to give a few recent examples, Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted in 2021 of sex trafficking young women for the benefit of her friend Jeffrey Epstein. And a few years earlier, in 2019, Alison Mack pleaded guilty to racketeering conspiracy, sex trafficking, and forced labour conspiracy while she was a member of Nexium, the MLM/sex cult led by Keith Raniere. Now, during her time in Nexium, Alison orchestrated and enabled the physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of a number of women in the group. We spoke about Epstein and Raniere in our episode on powerful men in season one of the podcast, but we didn't spend much time on the women who enabled them. Both Ghislaine and Alison used their own power and authority to subjugate the women and girls they trafficked and abused, and both used various forms of manipulation and coercion to ensure their victims' compliance and silence. But Ghislaine and Alison do have their supporters, who argue that both women are themselves victims. Ghislaine's friends and family believe that she was scapegoated for crimes that Epstein alone committed. She's a woman being unfairly blamed for the actions of a rich and powerful man. And Alison's supporters argue that Raniere coerced or brainwashed her so that she had no choice but to participate in the abuse. Now, I am not suggesting for a minute that Alison Mack and Ghislaine Maxwell can be compared to Sarah in any simple way. But these recent cases do make me think about how we evaluate Sarah's complicity, or perhaps her guilt, in Hagar's sexual subjugation. So, it's a lot to think about, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Kaz. And honestly, I'm not sure it has an easy answer.
No.
But it reminds me of the point raised by Wilder Gaffney about the social differences between Sarah and Hagar. Unlike Hagar, Sarah is a freeborn woman, and she would have enjoyed a certain amount of social privilege by being Abraham's wife. At the same time, though, Sarah was trapped in a patriarchal system where her social power was limited and her status diminished by her ongoing infertility. Both these factors may have led her to believe that using Hagar to bear Abraham's child was the only thing she could do. Now, this in no way excuses Sarah for compelling Hagar into a forced marriage and forced pregnancy, but it might help us understand why Sarah made that decision.
Sure, I can see that.
Another issue that Wilder Gaffney brings up might also be important here. On two separate occasions in Genesis 12 and Genesis 20, Abraham passes Sarah off as his sister, with the result that she's taken, temporarily, into a local ruler's harem.
Oh, why does Abraham do that?
In a nutshell, Abraham is worried that Sarah's beauty would attract the attention of local men who might be willing to kill her husband in order to claim her for themselves. So Abraham's ruse works to protect him, but only by sacrificing Sarah's own safety.
So Sarah will have learnt from these two occasions that women's bodies are expendable if they serve male interests.
Mm.
And certainly that's something I think Ghislaine Maxwell and Alison Mack will also have learned from Epstein and Ranieri. So do you think that's in any way a mitigating factor in Sarah's case?
Again, I don't think it justifies what Sarah did to Hagar, not for a second. But it might help us understand Sarah's motivations. In some ways, she was also a victim of the patriarchal world she lived in. But at the same time, she was willing to use the patriarchal system of enslavement to her own advantage, even when it meant inflicting terrible abuse on another woman in her own household.
Yeah, that's so true. So, do you have any closing thoughts about Hagar you want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, so I think this narrative is a really important reminder that gender is only one marker of identity that causes inequity and oppression. A person's social status, their ethnicity and race, their class, their able-bodiedness, and their age can intersect and sustain power imbalances that lead to various forms of oppression, including oppression perpetrated by women against more vulnerable women. I think Hagar's story highlights the importance of recognizing the complex intersecting aspects of inequity and oppression. What about you, Kez?
I think the story of Hagar reminds me how important it is to recognize the violence of enslavement when we encounter it in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, because this violence still gets overlooked within biblical scholarship. Or it's erased by biblical translations that refer to enslaved women as maidservants or handmaids. We can't afford to ever minimise or ignore the violence of enslavement as we read texts like Genesis 16 and 21. Because if we do, we're effectively diminishing and ignoring the tens of millions of enslaved women and girls around the world today who are experiencing forced marriages and forced pregnancies. And that would be unforgivable.
Agreed. So, shall we end this week's episode by telling our audience what we've been reading or listening to recently?
Sure. Well, one of my current favourite podcasts is called Missing. It focuses mainly on missing person cases, and it's hosted by Tim Pilleri and Lance Rinstierna. I really like the podcast because it always puts the victim at the centre of the narrative, and it engages with victims' families in a really respectful and empowering way. It also has a very strong focus on advocacy. Lance and Tim aren't just telling us entertaining stories about people who've gone missing. They're actively trying to help find out what happened to these people and to bring some closure and justice to their families and friends. So I would really highly recommend it.
Thanks. So I enjoyed listening to Sweet Bobby, which is a podcast which deep dives into an extremely sophisticated catfishing scheme. I'm hesitant to say too much more about it because I don't want to give anything away, but I think it touches on some of the themes we've talked about today. It's an absolutely wild ride and I really recommend it.
Oh, I will definitely check that out. So thanks for listening to this episode of the Bloody Bible podcast. The resources we used are listed in our show notes, which you'll find on our website, along with the links to our social media accounts.
But until next time, we'll sign off and say goodbye. Stay safe, everyone.
The Bloody Bible podcast is supported by funding from the United Kingdom Arts and Humanities Research Council as part of the Shiloh Project Research Grant. Special thanks to Professor Johanna Stiebert at the University of Leeds, who commissioned us to create the podcast and supported us into this second season. The podcast is produced by Carolyn Blythe, Emily Colgan, and myself, Richard Bonifant, who also recorded and edited each episode whilst apologising profusely on behalf of all men. Although not so much with today's episode. Our music is Stalker by Alexis Ortiz-Sofield, courtesy of Pixabay Music, and the podcast artwork was created by Sarah Lee West. Our social media links are found in the notes to this episode. Please leave us a 5-star review. Thanks for listening.